Hi everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Cameo Launch Short Film Podcast. We have two very different short films this week, but two very short short films this week. One is the introspective drama Mausoleum, directed by Jamie Luke Milligan. And the second is, I would call it a horror thriller, but it could also be called horror comedy to a certain extent. I don't know. What do you think about that one, George?
Yeah, I'd say it's a horror comedy. I mean, normally you would just call that a black comedy. But then after watching Mausoleum, which is definitely a black comedy, I have to say Double Tap. Yeah, it's a horror comedy, a horror-medy. Is there a word for that?
Horomedy.
A horomedy.
A horomedy.
I think I've got a cream for that.
Called Double Tap, directed by Eros Vlachos. And as you've already heard, joining me is the irreverent video wizard, George Moll.
Howdy. Hello, fans of short film.
Before we get into both of those films, I was lucky enough to sit down with the writer-director of Mausoleum and also its producer, Miguel Iriarte. And we had a chat about some of the experiences and challenges they had as they shot that short film on 35mm. Without further ado, here is Jamie Lee Milligan and Miguel Iriarte. The first person you will hear is Jamie Milligan. And enjoy. So joining us on the In the Green Room podcast today is the writer-director of Mausoleum, Jamie Luke Milligan, and producer, Miguel Iriarte. Guys, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
So we're going to talk about your short film, Mausoleum, and essentially it is a story about a woman at her wit's end, and she essentially confesses all of her inner frustrations and sources of her anger to her husband, and it's a last-ditch effort for this lady to regain some kind of control over her life by finally admitting what's been going on with her internally and what the issues have been within their marriage. And that leads to a core decision to make at the end due to a bit of a curveball that's thrown in the middle of that confession. So first and foremost, it's an incredibly well-made short and quite a short runtime as well. So it's about 5.5 minutes and largely a single shot. I mean, there are a couple of cutaways, but largely one shot. And also it has the distinct honour of standing out for most of the short films, and that it was actually shot on film, on 35mm film. So, yeah, fantastic work there, guys.
Which is why I think it's so short, because we couldn't afford to make it any longer.
Right. We only had one plan, that's the reality of it.
I mean, that's one of the things that people bring up quite often when they talk about how they used to shoot on film and then eventually start shooting on digital. Is they suddenly started doing loads more takes, and they would just let the camera run for absolutely ages, whereas before you'd have like a really set plan as to what you were going to shoot, how long you could do it for, how many, you probably down to how many takes you could afford to do as well. And now it's like, yeah, it's fine, we'll try again. Try from this angle, try from that, try with a different backlight. It's you know, and I think there's a certain discipline that is present when shooting something on film that probably isn't necessarily there now. Not that there are no disciplines being employed when you're shooting on digital, but you're very much kind of on the clock, as it were. So a couple of questions. So first, what were the sort of origins of the idea behind this story, and how did that then lead to the production that you decided to then put together and doing it on film?
Like, originally it was going to be a woman sat down and basically telling her husband that she's poisoned him, and with the same kind of twist outline that we've got. So I was quite excited by that, and I went home and wrote it, and then it kind of manifested into what it became. And it wasn't about poisoning, and it was about being stuck in a kind of rut, basically, and how you can get out of that. And what's been good with the film is that it has been like multi-generational, that it's not just women who are over 60 that feel those kind of thoughts, that it is everyone, like, at some point in their lives. So that's been a really like nice part of it. So just coming out from being bored in the stockroom at work and having an idea and going home and writing it, it was quite a quick writing process. It was just quite cathartic, really.
Brilliant. I mean, did you mentioned that you ran it past a couple of people. So what was sort of the general reaction to sharing the idea before you actually went ahead and did the script and shot the film?
Well, the first person I sent it to, well, I'd had it like for a month or two and then had another look at it. And I sent it to Chris Ferguson, who was the DAP on the film. And he read it and was like, right, let's make it. So that's kind of where it went from. And in my mind, I thought that we'd be putting like a grand in and doing it. And then things...
Nice, blew the budget.
Yeah. Things escalate. I was thinking, oh, I could put in £1,000 of my own money, and thinking, oh, that will go a long way, because, you know, it was never a thought of shooting it on film, and kind of thinking, do it in a real location and that kind of thing. And then things change. But yeah, so Chris was like, yeah, let's do it. So then I spoke to Mikel, sent it to him. I think this was all over Facebook Messenger. Right. And as the way that the industry seems to be run. And yeah, then it kind of just went from there, and we, yeah, built our crew. Mikhail could probably say more about building the crew and everything like that, but it was Chris really saying, let's make it, that kind of got it going, really.
Yeah, okay. We've worked with Chris before as well. We've done a music video together, the three of us, and, you know, Jamie and I have known each other for years before that, and we've each known Chris on our own terms as well. And he's a fantastic cinematographer who's come up from our local area, although he's not from around the Bournemouth area, but he shot a local film called K-Shot. So Chris is just a great sort of starter of any project. So I think, yeah, when he gave that kind of seal of approval, definitely for the two of us, it validated the project, because we were like, oh wow, if Chris is interested, then there must be something here. Right. Yeah, so it was fantastic working with Chris as well, and it was really his idea to shoot on 35. It was upon his insistence.
Brilliant. So once that idea had kind of taken root, you sit down, you've written the script, and you've decided on 35mm, does that then shape how you then start to assemble the team, the crew as a whole? Because obviously there are considerations you need to take on board with film that you don't necessarily have to if you're shooting on DSLR or a mirrorless camera. So did that kind of shape the production team you then formed, or did you call on people that you'd worked with previously?
It did inform like who we had. I think the exciting thing with, because we shot this in Bournemouth, and it was a crew of about 15 people on set, thereabout. Yeah. And half of that was London, half of it was Bournemouth. And shooting something on 35mm, it gave it, I don't want to say prestige, but it was something different that was being done. So it was easier to get people to want to be part of it.
Okay.
And I think, like, if we had shot on digital, there'd have been no element of risk to the film, so it wouldn't have been an interesting project to be part of. So that really kind of made it easier to get people to want to be part of it. And like with a short film, it's obviously, you know, there is no money in it. So having people who want to be there just goes such a long way. And yeah, so just building the crew from that, and like Chris had his camera team, and Mikhail found our production designer, Zoe Parker. And then from there, then everyone kind of fleshed out their departments, I guess.
I'm trying to remember, at which point did we decide that, because there's a very long tracking shot in film, and at what point did we decide, Jamie, that we weren't going to shoot on location? Because I remember there was discussion of what was a viable studio in the sort of surrounding 25 miles. But was that, I'm trying to think whether that did kind of have a knock-on effect of how we proceeded after that, when we decided that it was going to be a set.
Well, firstly, we looked at studios in London and couldn't afford them.
Crazy, wasn't it? Yeah.
They charged for the electricity on top of the space by the hour. So we were like, yeah, we can't do that. Then we were looking at locations, and nowhere looked like it would have been. Like, a lot of it was all like photography places and that kind of thing. And, you know, the lighting so bright. So fortunately, it was always going to be one take, one kind of like track in. But fortunately we had contacts with Treehouse Digital in Boscombe in Bournemouth, who had this tiny studio on the top floor of what used to be a Wimpy or Burger King.
And it's not Sainsbury's underneath.
Yeah. And so, like, during takes, you would hear, like, the do-do-do. Leading up on aisle five. But, yeah, so that kind of informed it. And then having, and, you know, they let us use their space for free, which was just amazing. Incredible. So, and they had flats there that we could build the set on and everything. So, like, things come along, like, especially with short films, where it's just favours falling into place. You know, that, you know, Mausoleum is that film. It, you know, it's just calling in your favours.
Yeah. Fortunately, have been huge advocates and supporters of the project from the off. And it was actually funny because we got an unexpected spark out of it as well, who was just their kind of, like, resident electrician, who we had never met, and then turned up on the day, and we were like, oh right, an extra crew member, okay, great.
Oh, amazing. And obviously you managed to secure Julia Deakin to appear in the film as well. For those who don't know, she's appeared in Spaced, Hot Fuzz, and Down Terrace, I believe. So how did that come about? Was she somebody that you knew through contacts or had been involved in projects before, or just reached out?
So yeah, well, basically we had a list of actresses that we were kind of, and because it was like a one day shoot, we thought it would be achievable to get someone who's relatively known. And then I watched High Rise, which is the Ben Wheatley film, and there's a scene that Julia's in where she pops up with Tom Hiddleston. I was like, geez, I recognise. Because at the time, you know, you're looking for any actress that could fit the part. And I was like, yeah, and then quickly Googled, and I was like, oh, bloody hell, yeah, it's Julia Deakin. So, Marsha from Spaced. So then we got in contact. Was it Curtis Brown?
Curtis Brown's our agent, yeah.
Yeah, and, a lot of back and forth.
Yeah, there was... It was interesting because we didn't get a kind of like absolute confirmation until just a couple of weeks before the shooting dates, isn't that right?
Right. It
was kind of like towards the end, I was like, you know, I need a confirmation or we're going to have to ask somebody else. And so it was a bit, we were having those discussions of like, oh God, what's going to happen if she says no? Because the script had been with her for like, you know, at that stage, probably like a month and a half, 2 months. So we were just like praying, waiting to hear.
Yeah.
But it turned out to be really lovely.
At that point, I was like, I'll stand in and do it, don't worry. If she can't get her, I'll have to put on the acting gloves. Yeah. But the hardest bit was finding the husband, really. That was,
okay.
That was a lot harder.
Yeah, I mean, we were really, really lucky with Julia, but... I think because we'd put all our eggs in her basket, so to speak, financially, it meant that we didn't have like an equivalent for the male character in it. But bearing in mind that, you know, his part is he's not really doing the heavy lifting of the scene. So we sought to find somebody locally, that proved harder than we expected, but Jamie pulled it out of the bag right at the last minute.
Brilliant. So where did you find him, or how did you find him?
A couple of years before, I tried to make a short film, and I got in contact with this actor called John, and me and my mate went to his house and talked through, and, you know, kind of thought, yeah, he would suit the part. He was too young for what I wanted at the time, but then, like, just kind of hit me as we were trying to find someone to, and, you know, like, seeing them together, Julia and John, they kind of look like a couple, and other people we were looking at just didn't kind of suit that aesthetic. So yeah, Mikhail and I went to his house after he'd had a hernia operation.
Yeah, I think he'd just come out of hospital. Yeah,
and he was pretty drugged up, and
but we were coming.
Saturday morning, we knocked on his door, and, you know, we were like, we just saw this like shuffling body coming along. He was like, what do you want? We're like, you never had a player. He had no idea who we were. So that was awkward. But apart from that, yeah, lovely guy.
Oh, he's amazing. He was absolutely brilliant. I think it was that quality, because there's certain allusions in the script of how she describes him that makes you think he could have been a bit of a rogue if what she's saying is true. And so for that reason, we had to find somebody who still kind of had that charisma in spite of the fact that they have virtually no lines.
Right, okay.
So that was why that was such a kind of integral and difficult part of the casting process once we'd obviously locked Julia, which we were really, really lucky to.
But as a typical actor, the only thing that he had read off the script was his line, which was the last one. So going into it, he didn't know anything else. So yeah, that again kind of added, I guess, something to it.
So as a director then, how did you approach directing somebody that is very well established, i.e. Julie Deakin, alongside somebody who's perhaps less well known, and how did you give them sort of equal ownership of the story that they were in and the project as a whole?
Yeah. So what was different with like this short film is that we had a day before of just rehearsing, and with it being a monologue, there's really not much directing you can do during it that you have to kind of stand aside. So there's an incredible photo of me and Julia like the day before, like going through the script, and you can see just how stressed I am. And all the colours like left my face, and I'm just like, oh, and you don't want to tell someone how to do it. And it was struggling to kind of get the monologue and for her to remember like stuff to hit on and that kind of thing. And like the night before, we were like cutting all these lines out and trying to get the time down, because, you know, like what was it, 4 pages of script was coming in at like 8 minutes of, and if it was that, it would have been so hard to even get it onto festivals, and you're having fewer takes to do it. Yeah. So we spent the day, like the Saturday before the shoot, just going through the script and for her to like put her voice to it and that kind of thing. And then on the day, she nailed it. Like, we did 4 takes, and like in hindsight, I wish that I had like kind of directed her more on the day.
Okay. But
in terms of like, but the problem was, it was in my mind of just getting that full take that we had. That was what I was concentrating on, and
yeah, and performance wise, I suppose as well.
Yeah. So, so it was a weird kind of like directing gig, because essentially I'd done my directing the day before, and once we had that, but you know, hindsight, if you know, it's a wonderful thing. But yeah, the performance we got was the best performance of the 4 takes, and she absolutely nails it, and there's, you know, a real like pathos to it. You just look at things and you learn, don't you? But directing, like the thing that astounded me with working with a professional actress is just how much they cared.
Yeah.
Like just coming and actually wanting to be there. You forget that like actors want to act.
Yeah, that's true. And I guess that's one of the advantages when you're doing smaller projects like this as well. If you're doing TV, I mean, a lot of the time the tone is set by whoever directed the pilot episode, and then everyone else just kind of has to fit into that. When you're doing a smaller project, a short film, even though you don't have as much financial freedom, you often have a lot more creative freedom. And I think that can be quite a bit of a draw. To actors, whether they are just starting out or have been in the business for years and are well known on TV and so on and so forth. So that being the case, was the crew at large able to kind of express different ideas for how they approach the project? You mentioned in your press kit that you sort of organically ended up with a 50-50 gender split as well. And one of the advantages to having a representative crew is diversity of ideas, essentially. So is that something you were able to take advantage of in this particular project? Was that the kind of atmosphere you had? Was it more a case of everyone just kind of gathering around your core concept?
Like, for me personally, I'm collaborative anyway. Like, it's like, directing's weird because you come away from it feeling you've not done anything. Whereas, like, there's a, like, Paul King, who directs Paddington, he says that, you know, the director's really there just to, like, find the smell of the film. So it's just if you weren't there, everyone would get on with their jobs and something would be made. But it's, yeah, it's so important just to let everyone like have their voice. But ultimately it's for you to kind of, you know, rein that in, I guess. But with this, there wasn't a huge amount that we could deviate with, I guess. Like it was always going to be that the bulk of it is a like 5-minute monologue, single track. That was, you know, the core concept, but it was just letting there be flourishes around that, I guess. I don't know, Mikhail, if you...
Yeah, I think from a production point of view, is like you say, the script and the aesthetic and tone and how we were going about it was all pretty nailed down once we got to that shoot. But from the behind the scenes point of view, I think that, yeah, everybody, like we were really lucky to create a very unique atmosphere because we had that rehearsal day beforehand. And one thing from my experience of going on to, you know, producing advertising and stuff like that is that you step onto set and everybody's running around like headless chickens. Unless people know each other from previous shoots, they have no idea what roles people are supposed to fit into, you know, how they relate to each other, who's doing what job. People across departments don't trust each other. So if they touch each other's gear or anything, there's like uproar, you know?
Right.
And so with this, what was really lovely is obviously the stakes were completely different with it being a short, but because we had that rehearsal day, we invited everybody. And so everybody met, and it was a bit like I framed it a bit like an AA meeting, unfortunately, because I was like, let's go around the circle, everybody introduce themselves, everybody tell us what you're going to do on the shoot. But like it just gave that opportunity for people, even though we were only going to spend, you know, less in reality than 48 hours together, it meant that we could build a familiarity and I think a camaraderie that really, really helped everybody push themselves and give each other insight and opportunity where perhaps there wouldn't be that time or space on, a corporate or advert shoot or even TV or a bigger budget film. You know, I think it was we were very, very lucky just by looking to find the most talented crew that were available around us that, naturally, we had this gender split across the middle, right. But also it just fostered like good vibes between everybody. And I think there's a lot of people who have carried on working together from that crew, who met each other and have remained friends. I mean, yeah, I think that the kind of lasting feeling, like even, I mean, perfect example is our production designer, Zoe Parker. Like Jamie and I are really, really, really close friends with her now, where we didn't really know each other at the beginning of the project. So yeah, there's been a lot of goodwill that's come out of the way we went about it, I think, rather than, you know, that was kind of dictated by what we were making, obviously. But that was pretty well, conceptualized beforehand by Jamie and Chris, I think.
Okay. I mean, is there any of that kind of atmosphere or the attitudes that were fostered during that process that you think you'll be able to take forward into future projects? Is that kind of shaped the way you'll approach things in the future?
For me, I'd say definitely. I think like the strength was the day before of just everyone like meeting. So we did a music video, I think a couple of years later, which is a very, very different vibe on set. And I had done a short just before Mausoleum, like a silent comedy. And sometimes like with camera crew, it can be a little bit us and them.
Okay.
And so like with Mausoleum, and just, yeah, like just introducing yourself just goes such a long way. Because, you know, like realistically at this level, you're all in the same boat. There should be no egos or anything like that. And, you know, introducing that kind of just like takes that away, I guess. It just takes the facade.
I think that, you know, we all slip into habits to deal with the monumental workload that is making films or videos professionally and as a hobby. And there's a lot of stress that comes with that. And so it can, you know, cause people to just kind of slip into these habits of like Jamie says, a bit us and them, unfortunately, sometimes. Right. So yeah, we were really able to break down those barriers. And I think that given the right amount of time and budget, you know, we were lucky that we could pull together a rehearsal day, but unfortunately that's just not always the case, dependent on the project and, you know, how run and gun or how organized or how much money you might have in the bank for it. But certainly would try and repeat that if it was possible. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of funding, actually, so you mentioned initially the plan was to kick in about £1,000 to do it, and then the plan to shoot on 35 came along. So were you able to find additional funding, and what were sort of your experiences with that?
So the film's entirely self-funded between myself and Chris and Mikhail as well, like toward the end of it, I think. So Chris, having wanting to shoot on film, he paid the whole camera side of it, and I paid the production side of it. Okay. So I think in total, the budget for the film was about six grand.
I think we brought in just under, but yeah, we didn't. We kind of toyed with the idea of applying for funding, but we felt that the urgency to get this film made, and with the availability of the people that wanted to be involved, we just wanted to move forward with it. And then we discussed crowdfunding, but I think all of us felt a little bit unsure of it, I suppose, in the sense of you see a lot of crowdfunders happen and then takes months or years for the backers to see any result, if any result comes of it at all. So, you know, we made the decision during pre-production that actually if we were going to crowdfund anything, we'd crowdfund for our festival campaign afterwards once we had a product that we could show people. Okay. So that's how we kind of went about it. Props to Jamie and Chris for putting in the lion's share. Otherwise, there would be no film.
Right. But it's one of those that, you know, ultimately no one's ever going to come up to you and say, can you make a short film? So you just kind of, like, I don't regret putting money into it at all. Because, you know, like Mikhail was saying, that when we crowdfunded for the festival fees, because, you know, festival fees are so expensive. And we did a crowdfunder with LiveTree, which is it BFI affiliated?
It was BFI affiliated, but it no longer exists in exactly the same capacity as it did then, so it's not just a crowdfunding site anymore.
Yeah, so we went through there and we thought, right, we'll put up 1200 is like our target, thinking that's going to be really hard to get to. And we did like four executive producer things of what, like 250 quid on top, because, you know, you think, oh, we'll just fill in those gaps on the application. But within like a few days, we had done nearly £1,000. And in the end, we finished on just over 2,000 with all the executive producer ones filled as well. Excellent. So that, which was, you know, like unbelievable. But because we had a film that existed, people could get behind it. Whereas like sometimes with crowdfunders, it's just a poster or it's a short teaser trailer.
Mm.
So there was less risk, I guess, for people wanting to put money into it.
We'd already begun to build a community around the film just through making the film as well. So we knew that we would have some sort of support from people during the crowdfunder to help us widen that community and invite more people in.
Okay. I mean, that those sort of restrictions being the case, and also taking into account what you just said, Mikhail, about communities kind of rallying around any given project, how does that shape your decision making in terms of making more short films in the future? And obviously, you have to look at the jobs you need to take in order to keep bills paid and so on and so forth, and also to put you that little bit further forward career-wise as well. But I guess one of the freedoms you have with a short is that you can kind of explore and exploit the ideas that you have, the specific ideas you have. So how do the restrictions that you've come up against and the kind of landscape you find yourself in, how does that affect your decision making in terms of making more shorts or which shorts to make?
Do you want to go for it, Jamie?
Yeah, sure. So like the thing is now with shorts that like the expectation is that you do 2-3 shorts and then you move on to a feature.
Mm.
So like for me now, it's to make a short film that is coming in like round about a 15-minute mark to see if I can sustain like 4 days of shooting, like to keep a story that way. And finding, you know, I couldn't fund a 4 day shoot. So then you do have to look at like funding options. And so like, we're lucky we've got the BFI Southwest network down here, which seem to be really open. And, you know, one of the best things with lockdown is that now people have time to pursue like avenues for like short films and such, that they can take the time to work on them and find, like, I think the strength of a short film is when you address an issue, whereas, because that's a real way of exploring something and getting it like seen, because, you know, realistically you're not going to make a feature for a few years. Mm-hmm. So you want to find your voice, like looking at the world and exploring it that way. And so fortunately there's so many schemes at the moment that are looking at minority groups and different you know, sexual orientations, like finding voices for them as well. And it is right. It's such a great time for short film, because, you know, so many people that can assess it, like, you know, the three of us right now could go and make a film like on Zoom. And it's something, you know, we're so lucky that we can like just make films, but unfortunately it just costs money to do some things. I think the money, it costs money to get them seen. I don't think it costs money to make them, if that makes sense.
Yes. You did make a short film on Zoom, Jamie, recently. So is that, like, speaking to that, do you think that, did that cost you a lot of money to execute, and what was the...
It cost me £25 for a Vickers outfit, which then, fortunately, the person wearing it kept it in good nick, so she sent it back and I got the refund. So, yeah, it's just about being creative, and it was a good thing to do. And, you know, from there, some friends of mine have done a Zoom thing that they were asking me for advice on. So, the best thing about doing filmmaking is the community of it, which is, you know, like, it, when you go to film festivals, like Aesthetica was the first one I'd been to, and it was just the amount of people that we met there and who have become friends from it. It's just such a melting pot of just finding people. That's the best thing about making films. It is just like connecting with others.
That's great. That is fantastic. And I mean, it is heartening to hear that as being a motivating factor. I mean, when you talk about, when you talk about community, when you talk about thinking about whether or not there's an audience, and I mean not just in terms of whether or not they'll watch it, but in terms of whether or not they'll actually get something from it, because ultimately that's going to be the bedrock as to whether or not they're going to continue to watch the things that you make, or if they're going to recommend the film they've just watched, and so on and so forth. And I think quite often that consideration isn't always there. So the fact that you've identified that specifically is definitely good to hear, because when you're talking about short films, especially short films you can watch online, yes, you don't necessarily have to pay with your money, but you do have to pay with your time. And unlike your money, your time is non-refundable. So the watching something like Mausoleum, when you can actually get into the inner recesses of somebody's fears or their anger or their frustration, and it's something that you can actually relate to, you can take something quite profound away from it within less than 6 minutes. When you're thinking about a potential audience member having that experience, I think that is a very powerful thing to actually motivate a film, not just being made, but just the way you make it, who you bring on board to help you make it, the atmosphere you want to make it in, and so on. And again, with that being the case, how do you think that affects what you feel the future of cinema might be? Because a lot of what you would do with a short film, when people first started doing them as a companion piece or as a showcase that would eventually lead to larger projects, the access to them was very, very, very small. Now, you know, you can put a film out and have thousands of people see it, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people see it. How do you think that will affect the future of cinema as a whole, especially now that we're looking at things like lockdown amid the coronavirus. Even if things start to get better, how quickly will that happen? And once they do get better, what will the landscape be at that point? And where will short film fit into that? Have you had many thoughts on that scenario?
I know I have, but have you, Jamie?
Firstly, with COVID and lockdown, the main thing to take away from it is that once this is over, we're going to have to relearn society. We're going to relearn how to be near people, which is just creating, that's going to keep people not wanting to go to the cinema so much. It's all right, like social distancing within seats in the cinema, but say if you're going through the foyer or you're going to loo and everything like that, that's going to be the might, and I think that will put people off. And
does it feel now though that you would just go and sit next to a stranger in the cinema?
Yeah, I mean, I usually go for an aisle seat, so I'm away from people. That's usually my tactic. But with Christopher Nolan's like just trying to save cinema, it's kind of, would he be so passionate if he didn't have a film coming out that they need to make the money back on? It's an interesting thing. And I think cinema's always going to exist, but I was reading in Sight and Sound this month that they've interviewed all like regional small independent cinemas, and a lot of them are saying that they just can't see how they're going to survive it because they're furloughing their staff and they've got no income coming in. There's the Rex in Wareham, which is near us, which is a freehold, fortunately, so they're not paying rent on that, but it's the first time in like 90 years that they've closed, and there's one that's like over 120 years old that's closed for its first ever time. It was open during the wars. Wow. That's how big this is that's going on, for those things. And fortunately we're finding, with the Trolls film that came out, Trolls 2, and how that went straight to VOD, that's gonna be like, a lot of people will think that, do we need a studio, do we need a cinema screening?
Well, case in point, Universal saying that they were then going to go day and date, and the reaction from Odeon and who's the
AMC, wasn't it?
AMC, that's right, yeah. Then saying that they're gonna take Universal out of any programming. And there was a little sliver of hope for me where I was like, oh my god, what is gonna take up that programming? Are they gonna start programming more Curzon Cinema? Are they gonna start programming more Artificial Eye? Are they gonna start programming more art house stuff? Are they gonna start, are they gonna do something different with those slots? But I think unfortunately with the multiplexes, you can't really rely on them to be that forward thinking. Nonetheless, I think that like Jamie said as well, like cinema's never gonna go away. Theatre didn't go away because we came up with films, and films haven't gone away, or cinemas haven't gone away because we came up with television, So there's always going to be a place for cinema, but I think more and more so since the advent of 3D and video on demand, like there's been a focus on event cinema and going and seeing a spectacle. But I'm hoping that actually, well, first of all, I think people are getting fatigued of that, Marvel and Star Wars, case in point, the Star Wars, they're still making plenty of money, but like people are getting more and more disgruntled about it. And I think that is going to drop off eventually. But I hope that in the advent of coming out of the other side of this, perhaps it gives more autonomy to audiences to actually say what they want to see. It's interesting actually because George is one of the other producers on Mausoleum. We've just been confirmed to receive some funding from Cinema For All and British Film Institute to set up community cinema, which is lacking.
Fantastic.
In Bournemouth area, so that would be a great, it's only a tiny bit of money, it's more like an experiment really, but to see if there is that demand and if we can drum up that kind of support for the community having their say of what's on screen. We want to focus on short films naturally, but I think that there is, people are looking to more diverse places to find not just entertainment but stories which connect with them. Our premiere event, we did a showcase of short films, not just Mausoleum, but from various filmmakers across the country and across the world, and the reception from the audience there was fantastic. I think Brilliant. Most people really were like, why are we going to the Odeon when we could do this? And it's like, well, because this is happening once.
Yes.
Next week. But you know, the response and because people can connect with a range of different stories in a shorter space of time, and actually that creates a more active discussion rather than, you know, people going to see one Marvel movie and their discussion is then, you know, whether Captain America is dead or not, or, you know, it seems a little bit less substantial than perhaps going and watching a bunch of shorts with connected topics that actually make you question, like, you know, your own life or the life of others around you.
I think that whole project sounds absolutely amazing. Please do keep us in the loop with where that goes. We'd definitely like to talk more about it.
Yeah, no, it's very early days. We only heard last week, but it should be really exciting. We're excited to see where we can go with it.
Fantastic. Just kind of circling back to what you mentioned about some of the bigger films coming out that are going to be quite reliant on cinema, and mentioning people like Chris Nolan. So he's been quite committed to cinema, not just in sort of speaking up for it, but also continuing to shoot on film. Of which he's quite famous for that. Did you feel that there was kind of a crossover in your decision to use film for Mausoleum, and how that might translate to people wanting to retain that kind of cinematic experience? I mean, you don't get more cinematic than shooting on film.
Well, instantly with film festivals, it just made you stand out. Yeah, it just feels like it's a physical thing. Like, it feels tangible. Mm. Like, Mikhail had the genius idea of getting film strips made of, like, 4 strips of the film, okay, which we were then handing out at festivals and to,
like a calling card, yeah.
Yeah, which, you know, made us stand out and gave it a little bit more buzz around it, I guess.
Yeah, props to CPC, by the way, who they printed Mausoleum back onto 35mm, because obviously we had to develop it and then digitize it, and then send it back to CPC as a DCP, and then they then printed it back onto 35, and we negotiated this deal that they would print these like 4 frames from the film in 35 that we could then give out, which was a great little marketing tool. So yeah, big up CPC, they're amazing. Doing most of the prints in the country, I believe, at the moment. And we in fact came to them through our friends at Dirt in the Gate, which is another sort of horror focused community cinema in Bournemouth, I guess. Yeah, the horror community, certainly go there. But yeah, I think it's, we haven't actually screened the 35mm version that we have. We haven't had an opportunity, just because it's so few and far between that you find a festival or a programmer that has the capacity to project 35.
Yeah.
But right in the gate, we're actually going to do, like, give the 35mm edition its premiere back in May, ahead of Shaun of the Dead. But unfortunately, with Corona, we haven't had the opportunity to do that.
Yeah.
That is a shame. Are there any plans to go ahead with that once the cinemas start to reopen, whenever that may be?
Most likely. I mean, you know, film is forever, so it can be shown later this year or next year, which is nice. Like, so yeah, it'd be nice to finally hear it on a projector being played.
It was such a buzz to hear it going on the day, though. Like, it, you know. Yeah, the reel going and the roll sort of going through the camera was just like, wow. And watching our camera team work, like, they were amazing. And just having that experience, I think, like, I mean, the decision was really came from that kind of almost like a time capsule effect, you know, from where I'm stood. But correct me, Jamie, you know, the way I took it was like, you know, we're capturing this moment between this couple, but they could be anyone, and it's got this kind of forever feeling about it, like it could be anyone, anywhere, even though, you know, we're just meeting these two characters right now. But But yeah, so it felt right to be shooting on film. Gave it that more timeless quality, I think. And then obviously, yeah, it did affect our process in shooting it. As I assistant directed as well, it certainly sort of sharpened up my calls and stuff of like, are we really ready? Click record. Are we all ready? Right, like everybody is on the ball right now, which is a pleasure. Really, it's nice to work in that situation where everybody's kind of just taking a little bit more care over exactly what they're doing at any given moment. But I think I hope that film will continue to have a place. I think that that in a similar way to recording on tape or playing vinyl, like you've seen a massive resurgence in vinyl in the last few years. And I don't think that film will ever go away because it's an aesthetic choice. And actually we've seen after a dip, we're seeing shooting on film is now on the rise again. And the same in fact with like camcorders and tape, like working, like producing adverts. I've had so many requests for sections to be shot on mini DV.
Really?
And it is fun. Like as a shooter, it is fun to shoot on mini DV, but it's not the same quality level. And then you've got like these like places in Soho that hire out mini DV and do mini DV conversion. That it's absolute daylight robbery. But it's nobody does it anymore. So they've forgotten how, and they don't have the equipment. So they're renting out like a mini DV camera for like £60 a day, and it's only worth £60.
Oh wow.
But I think that because of people's aesthetic choices and the nostalgia effect that any given format will have on people, I think that I hope that there'll always be a place for film.
I think the difference now with film is that it's not as expensive to shoot on film. Like shooting digital's really expensive anyway, and it's something that I didn't realise until we shot on film that actually doing it on film probably worked out that little bit cheaper.
Oh really?
Yeah, not a huge amount, but it was I'm not sure
that would be right on Mausoleum just because it was a single day, but definitely
we had a really good deal on our
we'd have a very good deal, yeah,
which rental as well. But like in terms of like your like the file size, and you're then having to buy all these hard drives on top if you're shooting digital,
got DIT there as well, so you've got to hire a whole extra person.
So it is, yeah. So it's a weird one. But one thing that we've not discussed, like in terms of it being on film and that kind of aesthetic, is the sound design on it as well.
Right. Okay.
We managed to get like through Twitter again. This show's community, Anamai Burtmark, who worked on Lynn Ramsey's You Were Never Really Here, and he was a sound designer who won the BIFFA for God's Own Country, Francis Lee's film. And that, again, was just reaching out to someone and, chancing your arm and the sound, that because there's no music to our film. It is all sound. And one thing was the noise that came from the camera on the sound.
Right.
Had to get dealt with. And just everything that she brought to the film just like really made it feel real. And, going with 35 kind of grain on it and just having professional sound on it, like sound is always forgotten about especially short films, and with it being so heavy on sound design, that really kind of elevated it as well, I feel.
Yeah, it's just a very good point you make. In fact, I forgot to ask about it, which is a good point. So, absolutely. I mean, the sound mix and sound design of any given film can just add a whole new dimension to it. It's not just capturing it clean. There's a whole character to the film that comes along with the way it's done. I mean, if you look at something like Star Wars, so much of that, more of that than you might think, is down to the recognizable sounds within it. So with that, I mean, you bring up sound as an example, but what other sort of lost disciplines did you discover on this film shooting 35mm that you think aren't being employed as much anymore?
Good question. That is a good question.
I guess, like, one thing it's not such a technical thing, but it is just making sure that there's like real focus on set.
Mm-hmm.
That you have rehearsed it and you know the camera movements, because you know, like our one relies on a camera movement all the way through it and at the end, and making sure that everyone just knows. Whereas on digital, you think, okay, if we cock it up, we can just start again easily.
Yeah.
Just, there was finite amount of times that we could reset and go. So I think for me, maybe that's something that I learned from this that I hadn't been so conscious of before.
Right. Yeah, I think with what we had available to us, we were as ambitious as we could be. Okay. You know, we like not only were we shooting on 35, and that was unfamiliar to a lot of people on set, but then and even to Chris, actually, it was his first time shooting on 35, so there was a bit of a gamble there, although we were all very, very confident in him and his team. But then also, you know, the long take nature of it,
mm-hmm.
not only is that ambitious for the camera team, but it's very ambitious for Julia.
Yeah,
and then right at the end of that take, there's an additional camera move. So you know, we could have messed up that camera move, and the whole rest of the speech is done for. You know, so and the nature of the fact that we were like, no, we're going to do a whip pan, and we're going to do a real whip pan. We're not going to edit this whip pan. You know, and we want to do it for real. So I think that we did stack up the odds relatively against us, but right. I think it really, really paid off. Personally, I think, yeah, that focus was really key. And again, why that rehearsal day was so crucial. I mean, as an assistant director, like, I can't really think of many situations where I've had an easier job, to be honest, because the crew were so of the right mind frame. And that comes down to, you know, just good planning on you know, everybody's behalf and a really, really receptive crew.
Excellent. Brilliant. So what future projects do you have in the pipeline at the moment? I know it's difficult to know when you'll be able to actually go ahead with anything, but is there anything that's kind of bubbling at the moment?
Just like everyone, just loads of writing at the moment. Yeah. So I'm just doing loads of collaborating. I'm doing one with, you had Paul Holbrook on the other week talking about Shiny. So I'm co-writing something with the co-writer of Shiny, Graham. Which is good, which is, you know, just getting used to just working with other people as well, and like co-writing a sitcom and starting a feature and maybe doing another short. But yeah, it's all so many things because you got time, which, you know, is such a commodity that you just don't, it's just trying to have stuff going, but again, it comes down to money.
Yeah, true. So I guess it's you're in a position where you can play around and develop ideas and then see what takes once things start moving again.
It's a case of, you know, like Mausoleum, we shot 3 years ago, so it's just kind of wanting to do the next thing, really, but making sure that it is the right thing to do. We were close to doing a short earlier this year, Mikel and I, with a lot of the team of Mausoleum, which was location dependent.
Definitely shouldn't have happened now.
Yeah, and you know, that was going to be on 16mm, and everything around it was going so well, but, and it wasn't due to Corona that we couldn't do it, but it's a shame. But again, like, it's a script that it's not going to go away.
No,
right.
That one was hinged on access to a water park, so that was just it was quite a complicated procedure, really, and the timing just didn't really line up. Mm. For me, I'm going a bit of a different direction. Like, since Mausoleum, I sort of took to producing more full time, and within particular, like, it was interesting you asked about working on more short films since then, and I really focused my attention to assistant directing. To assist smaller films through. I actually worked with Paul Holbrook that way as well on Hungry Joe, and I've worked with some amazing directors as an AD. But actually, ultimately, I found that career-wise, because I was producing more on the advertising side of it, I was finding myself pulled further and further away from really working on stuff that I did feel had a point and had a message and was going to connect with an audience in a valuable and a valid way. So actually I've just started training to become a secondary school teacher.
Really?
In the hope that actually alongside that I can focus on the projects ultimately once I'm trained and I have the time and room to that I'll be able to focus on the projects that I do think are valuable and valid and apply those skills less consistently perhaps but with less constant stress that comes with working in the advertising industry.
Yeah. Wow, that's a noble step. That's really cool. That's really good. I hope it all pans out. So with regard to Mausoleum, where can people see it at the moment? I know it's on Vimeo, but are there any online festivals it's currently playing at or online screeners?
Yeah, it's available for anybody to view now on YouTube, Vimeo or Facebook. Facebook page, so give that a little like. We're currently just sharing different short films pretty much daily. Just short films from around the world that we love that we hope to help find an audience as well through this.
Fantastic. Well, anyone listening to this podcast won't have to go far as the link to Mausoleum will be included in the episode notes. So give that a click and give it a watch. You definitely won't regret it. It's a great short film. You mentioned the Facebook page that people can go to. Can you give us your socials just so people can find you or see anything that you've been posting film-wise?
Yeah. My Twitter is at Jamie Milligan and Instagram is at Millie Snap.
And you can find Mausoleum's Facebook page at facebook.com/Mausoleum, a short film. And my Twitter is Mr. M I Rate. And my Instagram handle is Mr. Mikel 91. If you want to keep up with the news that way.
Fantastic. So, yeah, definitely, guys, check this film out. Check these guys out. We are very, very grateful that you were able to join us today. And keep us in the loop with future projects, with your cinema projects as well. And definitely hope to catch up with you again soon. So that was Jamie Milligan and Miguel Uriarte, writer-director and producer of Mausoleum, respectively. So this film, as I'm sure you're able to gather from the interview itself, is essentially the inner thoughts of a woman on the edge of her sanity almost, realizing as time is essentially running out at her on her life that she needs to regain some form of control over it, makes a huge confession as to what she really thinks of her life, what she really thinks of her husband, and of course that. Leads to a twist which gives her a sort of choice right at the end of the film. I thought this was incredibly well done. It is very mood driven, it's very atmospheric, and the majority of it is one tracking shot towards the main character played by Julie Deakin, who you will have seen in probably most famously in Spaced, as Simon Pegg and Nick Frost's landlady.
Martha.
Simon Pegg and Julie Stevens' landlady. Nick Frost does not live in the building.
No.
That's me.
Until season
to
two.
Myself.
Until season two, he does actually live with Martha. So technically, you were technically correct. The best way to be correct.
Yeah, okay, never mind. But anyway, Julie Deakin, a very established actor and a fantastic actor as well, particularly with the performance that she gives in this film, as she goes deep into sort of not only just her feelings towards her husband but also her self-loathing as well, and there's a lot of truth in her face. You can just see it, the anger, the revulsion, the regret, it's all there, and she just does it so very well. It's actually very engrossing. There's very little that actually gets applied to this film in terms of different shots, different cuts, transitions, or a score, and it doesn't need any of those things. It's literally a look straight into the inner thoughts of this woman at her wit's end, as all of those unchecked, suppressed feelings come bubbling to the surface. And I think she absolutely nails that. George, what did you think of it?
I actually thought it was brilliant and very uncomfortable. And again, I'm just going to say this. It's another film not to watch if you have misophonia. Or do watch it, because it's going to make you very uncomfortable. From the very, very beginning, when I saw food, I went, oh. I was having flashbacks to that film Hungry Joe, which, first of all, already was quite unsettling, so put me in that vibe. And then I heard the scraping of the cutlery against the plate, and the ketchup, and the cut as the ketchup is splattered on and then flips over. I thought that was so brilliantly done. But yeah, very, very loud. And then I even wrote down the quote about how we're eating in silence, and I went, it's not quite silence because I'm hearing all these noises, but very, very well done. Like, if that is the kind of silence you get, because there never is true silence, but if the silence is your husband just clattering around with his knife and fork all over his plate, I'm not surprised she doesn't want to hang around for much longer. But that close-up, that slow sort of track in all the way, one take, and then you're at some point, I'm like, is it going to stop before our face, or is this going to be a super close-up? And it does. I think it goes all the way super close-up and then stays there for so long. Any other film would have cut. But it keeps you there. And it goes from uncomfortable to unsettling to engaging, because you're this close, back to uncomfortable again. And then when it finally slides around back to the husband after all this time just hearing him eating in the background, it is it's such a great reveal. And yeah, it stayed with me, definitely.
And it's a you bring up sort of the sound of silence, if you like.
Yeah.
And it's another example of different craft within filmmaking, where if it's done well, you don't notice it. So one of the things that people probably wouldn't notice is the sound design of this film, but it's absolutely integral to the tone that is set, to being a reflection of the mindset of Julie Deakin's character, and it complements the sort of lighting style that's employed as well in working in unison. Especially with Julie Deakin's performance, it just makes the whole thing so immersive and atmospheric. You feel what is driving everything that she's saying. So yeah, it's a very well made, well directed, and well performed short film, and we definitely recommend that you check that out. The link to that film is in the episode notes for this episode, so give that a click and give it a watch as soon as you have the time. It's 5.5 minutes long as well. It's not a long short film, but what an engrossing 5.5 minutes. So that is Mausoleum, and check that out as soon as you can. Moving on to our second film. George, when you told me about this one, I had to have a look anyway, but when I gave it a watch, I was quite shocked about the fact that I was hooked that quickly.
Yeah.
She's basically just swiping through social media, and that very much drives the style of the film.
Yes.
And it's done in kind of a way where the cutting style and the colour of the film itself, it's all kind of reflective of the way social media kind of grabs you.
Pastel colours.
It doesn't stay on any one thing for very long. So the cuts are very, very quick. The swiping is very, very quick. You go from long shots to mids to close-ups to back to mids, back to close-ups, back to... And it keeps doing that. It keeps you from actually settling on any one thing. So you're seeing lots, but taking in very little. And that in itself is actually a genius move. It then takes a turn when the main character sees a post of a pretty freaky-looking guy saying, like this picture or he'll eat your blood.
Yeah.
And we've all had those messages where
been
it's
there.
Like, we're always encouraged to like something and share something, otherwise you get 7 years of sabbatical or something stupid. But this one is like the picture or he'll eat your blood. And then the tension kind of ratchets from there she regards it, the way she regards everything, as just something to either like, not like, and get rid of and never think about again. And she basically then becomes the victim of the fact that this was not an idle threat, and that's basically where the horror element to it comes from. Now it's described as a comedy, but I think they did the horror elements a little bit too well.
that's one way of saying
looking at it objectively, yes, it is very funny, but it also does the moments where she is trapped, where her life's in danger and stuff like that, it's done really, really well. Going back to sort of like the David Sandberg films we've watched, it does a similar thing in that it pulls you in and ratchets up that tension really, really quickly, but not in a jarring way. So, George, what were your thoughts on it?
Oh, yeah, I'm just going to pick up on quite a few things you said there. I wrote down quite a bit on this. I clicked on this short, and I saw it was full screen, and it was her eyes, and it had, a heart light LED in her eyes. So that was already enticing. And then I saw it was only about 3.5 minutes. But actually watching it, it's 2:50. It's literally about 3 minutes totally. And I went, okay, right, let's give it a go. Let's see. But you're right. It almost didn't have the right to get so tense. And not just tense, because the horror aspect doesn't really happen until about a minute getting into it. But it's already just the vibe, the overly pastel sort of colours and the highly saturated filmic look, like the loot that they've used and the colour grading is so nice. It's the kind of world where you're like, yeah, to be fair, if I had that bedroom and that lighting scheme and everything, I would be taking photos and liking photos on Instagram all the time. It both looked like a young girl's bedroom and also the set of a young girl's bedroom without feeling like taking you out of the film, which already, like, everything, the mise-en-scene as soon as the film starts was so engaging. But yeah, I'd say this is like, I agree with you of how quick the editing is and how they don't mess around with shots. You're just quickly shown something and then immediately cut to the next thing. Though I wrote down here, I said, this is the Instagram short horror comedy for the TikTok generation because it's those short clips. It's how our attention spans, how we've only got 5 seconds to engage someone on a video or a photo when they're scrolling past on their phones nowadays. So TikTok is all these quick edited videos with music and everything. And I'm seeing that happening a lot more with both trailers for films themselves, yeah, and the sort of media we consume. It's getting faster and the jokes are coming quicker and you're not even realizing they're there sometimes until you watch it on a loop for the second time, which is what a lot of even music is getting that way as well now. But I think the modern day email chain forward has been updated to a Instagram double tap on a photo, and if you happen to not do it, will it come true or not? You'll find out, basically. I really enjoyed the phone dropping parts. Really great cuts there with the phone drops. I even wrote down here, great gag, a really great repeated gag. As I write this, I've just dropped my phone into the bin, because I did. This was yesterday when I was watching the film and I was furiously taking notes and I put my phone down and it fell straight into the bin. So well done, me. Like most horror, great audio and Foley. The taps sound so satisfying that they themselves become addicting and you're waiting for the next tap to come. And it has its own rhythm, this short.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just thought it was really tense. It was a great horror comedy kind of mix. They definitely did the horror almost too well. To the fact that IMDb and all these other review sites can't even work out if it's just a horror or just a comedy. But absolutely recommending this one. It's under 3 minutes. You'll be engaged within about 10 seconds. So definitely recommend it.
100%. 100%. So two solid recommendations, I'd say, this week that won't take up 10 minutes of your time.
Literally. And all we've got right now is more than 10 minutes, so there's no excuse.
So, check that out. So that is Double Tap. The link to watch that is also in the episode notes. So give that a watch. If you are a filmmaker looking to have your film highlighted, reviewed, and promoted on our platform, then please feel free to send a submission to us via our Film Freeway page. So that's filmfreeway.com/cameo launch showcase. And if you are hoping to just stay up to date with any new reviews, any new movies that we're highlighting, then subscribe to our newsletter via our website, cameolaunch.com. You can also stay in touch on the socials, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, using the handle @cameolaunch. So continue to stay safe. We hope you get to see your loved ones again very, very soon. And hopefully we will see you all soon. Take care.
Bye.